a kind of Victorian Superman. He was born in 1824 in Belfast, the son of a professor of mathematics at the Royal Academical Institution, who soon after transferred to Glasgow. There, Kelvin proved himself such a prodigy that he was admitted to Glasgow University at the exceedingly tender age of 10. By the time he had reached his early 20s, he had studied at institutions in London and Paris, graduated from Cambridge, where he won the university's top prizes for rowing and mathematics, and somehow found time to launch a musical society as well, been elected a Fellow of Peterhouse, and written, in French and English, a dozen papers in pure and applied mathematics, of such dazzling originality that he had to publish them anonymously for fear of embarrassing his superiors. At the age of 22, he returned to Glasgow University to take up a professorship in natural philosophy, a position he would hold for the next 53 years. In the course of a long career, he lived till 1907 and the age of 83, he wrote 661 papers, accumulated 69 patents, from which he grew abundantly wealthy, and gained renown in nearly every branch of the physical sciences. Among much else, he suggested the method that led directly to the invention of refrigeration, devised the scale of absolute temperature that still bears his name, invented the boosting devices that allowed telegrams to be sent across oceans, and made innumerable improvements to shipping and navigation, from the invention of a popular marine compass to the creation of the first depth sounder. And those were merely his practical achievements. His theoretical work in electromagnetism, thermodynamics, and the wave theory of light was equally revolutionary. In particular, he elaborated the second law of thermodynamics. A discussion of these laws would be a book in itself, but I offer here this crisp summation by the chemist P.W. Atkins just to provide a sense of them. There are four laws. The third of them, the second law, was recognized first. The first, the zeroth law, was formulated last. The first law was second. The third law might not even be a law in the same sense of the others. In briefest terms, the second law states that a little energy is always wasted. You can't have a perpetual motion device because no matter how efficient, it will always lose energy and eventually run down. The first law says that you can't create energy, and the third that you can't reduce temperatures to absolute zero. There will always be some residual warmth. As Dennis Overby notes, the three principal laws are sometimes expressed jocularly as 1. You can't win, 2. You can't break even, and 3. You can't get out of the game. He had really only one flaw, and that was an inability to calculate the correct age of the Earth. The question occupied much of the second half of his career, but he never came anywhere near getting it right. His first effort in 1862 for an article in a popular magazine called Macmillan's suggested that the Earth was 98 million years old, but cautiously allowed that the figure could be as low as 20 million years or as high as 400 million. With remarkable prudence, he acknowledged that his calculations could be wrong if sources now unknown to us are prepared in the great storehouse of creation. But it was clear that he thought that unlikely. With the passage of time, Kelvin would become more forthright in his assertions and less correct. He continually revised his estimates downward from a maximum of 400 million years to 100 million years to 50 million years, and finally, in 1897, to a mere 24 million years. Kelvin wasn't being willful. It was simply that there was nothing in physics that could explain how a body the size of the Sun could burn continuously for more than a few tens of millions of years at most without exhausting its fuel. Therefore, it followed that the Sun and its planets were relatively, but inescapably, youthful. The problem was that nearly all the fossil evidence contradicted this. And suddenly, in the 19th century, there was a lot of fossil evidence. 6. Science red in tooth and claw. In 1787, someone in New Jersey, exactly who now seems to be forgotten, found an enormous thigh bone sticking out of a stream bank at a place called Woodbury Creek. The bone clearly didn't belong to any species of creature still alive, certainly not in New Jersey. From what little is known now, it is thought to have belonged to a hadrosaur, a large duck-billed dinosaur. At the time, dinosaurs were unknown. The bone was sent to Dr. Caspar Wistar, the nation's leading anatomist, who described it at a meeting of the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia that autumn. Unfortunately, Wistar failed completely to recognize the bone's significance and merely made a few cautious and uninspired remarks to the effect that it was indeed a whopper. He thus missed the chance, half a century ahead of anyone else, to be the discoverer of dinosaurs. Indeed, the bone excited so little interest that it was put in a storeroom and eventually disappeared altogether. So the first dinosaur bone ever found was also the first to be lost. That the bone didn't attract greater interest is more than a little puzzling, for its appearance came at a time when America was in a froth of excitement about the remains of large, ancient animals. The cause of this froth was a strange assertion by the great French naturalist, the Comte de Buffon, he of the heated spheres from the previous chapter, that living things in the New World were inferior in nearly every way to those of the Old World. America, Buffon wrote in his vast and much esteemed Histoire Naturelle, was a land where the water was stagnant, the soil unproductive, and the animals without size or vigor, their constitutions weakened by the noxious vapors that rose from its rotting swamps and sunless forests. In such an environment, even the native Indians lacked virility. They have no beard or body hair, Buffon sagely confided, and no ardor for the female. Their reproductive organs were small and feeble. Buffon's observations found surprisingly eager support among other writers, especially those whose conclusions were not complicated by actual familiarity with the country. A Dutchman named Comte de Pau announced in a popular work called Recherche philosophique sur les Américains that Native American males were not only reproductively unimposing, but so lacking in virility that they had milk in their breasts. Such views enjoyed an improbable durability and could be found repeated or echoed in European texts till near the end of the 19th century. Not surprisingly, such aspersions were indignantly met in America. Thomas Jefferson incorporated a